What I want to tell you about is a little bit about cosmology and the work that I do. But actually, I want to tell you a little bit more. What I'm really telling you about is the work that the cosmologists in the world do. Because you can't separate out the efforts of a single person anymore. We all work together and collectively in cosmology to try and improve our understanding of the universe. And we're trying to do something that in a given field of science you only get to do once, which is, let me move this down a bit, I think, which is to help it make the transition from being an uncertain science to quite a precise science. And certainly from my background as a physicist, I'm aware that certain subjects have their era, such as thermodynamics, for example, was all done in the 1800s. And at the end of that, it was more or less solved. And the way it's taught in the university today is more or less the same as the way it was taught 100 years ago. Quantum mechanics, similarly, in the 1920s, 1930s. And cosmologists, me and other people, are feeling ambitious at the moment. We're feeling brave, and we're feeling that we're now in a position where we can start to lay down a model of cosmology that might have the sort of longevity of other physics theories that people have discussed through the era. We may be completely wrong, but these are our ambitions. And the ambitions come about for several reasons, and I want to highlight three things that make it possible, of which by far the most important is the kinds of observational data people take in astrophysics these days. What happened, I think, is about 20 years ago or so, funding agencies and scientists and then funding agencies became aware that there were problems in cosmology that could be solved if the right kind of investment was made in particular dedicated scientific instruments to learn things about our universe. And so a lot of investment went into these cosmological areas, and some of the projects have been very long-term, satellite projects, for example, which are only really bearing fruit around about now. And so we're starting to get really very, very high quality data that we can use to learn about our models. So that's been the main driver, and that's where most of the money has gone. Scientific investment in cosmology has largely been in observations. But there are two other things that have been very important for us as well. I'm a theorist, and so what I'm mainly interested in is the development of theoretical models to try and interpret the kinds of observations that come along. And then the other thing is that we have very powerful computers, and without these powerful computers, it turns out we'd neither be able to get the data or analyze it or understand what our models mean. So all of these three legs have come together at this epoch and for the first time given us a chance to try and learn about our universe and pin down some of its properties in very high detail. So what I wanted to do was just have one slide. I still don't like this microphone too much. I'm going to keep moving it down until it's hardly there at all. These three things have come together, as I say, around about this epoch. Now, I want to very briefly in one slide just try and explain a little bit about what a mathematician or physicist does so that you understand roughly what I'm going on about during this lecture and can then forget about it again. So mainly what I want to aim towards is really a more historical overview of progress in cosmology. But I'm going to use a word quite often, which is the word model. And most of us in this room are scientists or mathematicians or physicists, but not everyone. I want to be clear what's meant by a model. If I talk about a model of the universe, what do I really mean? A model is not an actual physical object that you sit around and stick together with glue. It's generally speaking a collection of ideas, mathematical ideas probably, which are trying to capture some aspect of the real world. You don't try and explain the whole real world in a mathematical model. You decide what kinds of things am I interested in explaining. It might be, in cosmology, the formation of galaxies, for example. What are the ingredients I need to try and understand how that took place? More mundane, if we're on Earth, it might be understanding the weather. What sort of things do I have to learn in order to be able to predict what the weather will be in Brighton tomorrow or the next day? Now, models come in two separate parts, usually, when you're sticking together a model. And the first part's very important. The first part is you have to have clever ideas. Clever ideas are a good thing. You can't have too many clever ideas, but actually, they're very, very thin on the ground. And I would say in cosmology, there are literally a handful of clever ideas that people use. And by clever ideas, what I mean is a concept that gives you some real insight into the way the universe works. There. Examples of clever ideas are the following. Oops, pinged one too far. Are things like these: a theory of gravity, the hot Big Bang cosmology, quantum mechanics, an idea about how the universe works that you can then take forward, but something quite profound. The example I actually want to talk about in a little more detail is none of these ones, but instead I want to mention Einstein's theory of relativity. Some of you are familiar with you, some of you aren't, but probably most of you know that relativity hinges on a single idea, the idea that all observers measure the speed of light to be the same. And that was Einstein's original insight. But that very simple statement leads to very deep consequences. From that single insight, Einstein learned that he can no longer treat space and time as separate entities. He has to unify them together into space and time, space-time together. Ultimately, the same idea leads to E equals mc squared. It explains the atomic bomb, for example, is the energy released when you reconfigure a certain amount of mass. These are the sort of clever ideas that tell you something fundamental about how the universe works. And relativity is a particularly good example because it applies to all other physical theories, such as quantum mechanics, has to be consistent with Einstein's ideas of relativity. But the thing I want you to take away from this slide is just that there are clever ideas, and there are very, very few of them around, and so people like me don't deal in clever ideas, generally speaking. We deal the next level down. And the next level down we call parameters. By parameters, what we mean is things you actually go and measure that tell you the detailed properties of where you live. Now, parameters are examples of things like this. Strength of gravity is one, what's holding us to the Earth, how fast the universe is expanding, and then to relate back to relativity, the speed of light. Einstein has this fantastic idea. The speed of light's a constant. Everyone measured it, it has the same value for everyone. That's very deep insight, but what that idea does not tell you is what the actual speed of light is. You have to go away and measure it. And if you do go away and measure it, you find that it's very, very fast. 186,000 miles per second is the speed of light. But there's no fundamental reason why it has to be that speed. There's no reason why the speed of light isn't 50 miles an hour. And you might find that the effects of relativity were important in your day-to-day existence. But it happens that our universe is not like that. So what we have to do in theory like this is actually go and measure the speed of light in order to understand our universe. And most of what I'm going to talk about is in that second domain. It's the domain of measuring properties like the speed of light, the strength of gravity, and other things. The only other thing I want to say about models is that if a model is going to be much good, there's two things it has to have. First of all, it should be consistent with the observations you have. You should be able to explain whatever it is you've seen. However, it should also be predictive. Scientists don't much like models that don't make predictions because it's very easy to fiddle your models so as to agree with whatever data you have at hand. So an example is, suppose you throw a dice there. Before you throw the dice, you don't know what number it's going to be. If I threw the dice and said, and it came up a 3, and then I said, oh yes, I predict that's a 3, you wouldn't be very impressed because I've just looked at it and said it's a 3. I clearly didn't make much of a prediction. On the other hand, if I said it's going to be a 3 and then I throw it, and indeed it is a 3, that might get you thinking, did I really know that was going to be a 3 for some reason? I've made a prediction, the prediction's been verified. Maybe whatever reason I have to think that would happen is a good reason and does explain why the dice has ended up that way. So these are the two sides that we want to have in our models. However, I want to now step away from all of that detailed thing. That's context, if you like. And I want to talk a little bit about history and where cosmology came from and try and put the different ingredients into their historical context. So the place I'm going to start is with this guy. By my reckoning, cosmology as a modern science is almost exactly 100 years old, and it started with Albert Einstein. Around 100 years ago, we knew essentially nothing about our universe. Nothing of any reliability at all that would be regarded as reasonable today. And during that last 100 years, we've made the transition from that position to having quite detailed ideas of what the universe is like and what it's made of. And Einstein started this all going. Einstein, obviously, very famous person, maybe the most famous scientist ever, seen here around 1905 when he's inventing special relativity and in 3 famous papers completely overturning physics as was known before then. Here seen much later in his life, I think in the 1930s, probably after he'd already moved to America. Now, he's mostly famous to people who are not experts for E equals mc squared and space-time. And that was special relativity from 1905, but for working physicists, he had a greater level of achievement, a thing known as the general theory of relativity, and that came along much later in 1915. And the thing which distinguished this theory from his earlier work is that it explained gravity. It was a theory of how gravity works. And up until that point, everyone had thought that gravity worked as an inverse square law. This was the idea handed down by Newton from more than 200 years earlier. The inverse square law stood the test of time, but ultimately Einstein realized that it wasn't the complete theory of gravity. He replaced it with his own theory of gravity, which goes under this kind of funny name here. By writing down a proper theory of gravity that could apply in all environments, he opened the door to making models of cosmology. So other things this opened is theory of black holes. Theory of black holes didn't exist as a proper theory before Einstein's gravitational model came along. Indeed, Einstein was the first person to make cosmological models. He was working with a guy called Willem de Sitter, a Dutch mathematician, invented the first models that were supposed to describe the universe. The trouble is, those models believed that the universe was fixed, static, unchanging, and it turned out this was not the correct model, and these ideas were soon discarded. However, things were taken forward by this guy, Alexander Friedman. Very soon afterwards, 1922, he was a Russian mathematician working in St. Petersburg, and he created the first expanding universe models. He used Einstein's theory, but he looked at it from a slightly different direction and found that he could get the universe to expand. And the models that he created are called now the Friedman models. We still use them. It's almost 100 years later when I write something in my papers. They're Friedman models. I use the Friedman equation as derived by Friedman. They are the basis of modern cosmology as we understand it. And he made an interesting observation. Having looked at his expanding universe models, he discovered there were not only one kind of universe. He discovered there were actually three. There's pictures that go with this, and the thing that distinguishes the universe is what the shape of space is. We don't have to worry about this too much. But he realized there were three possibilities. The space, the universe, might be flat, or it might be curved. And if it was curved, it could close up on itself like a sphere, or it could curve a bit like a saddle. And he called these closed, open, and flat models. And I mention this because this is the first example of a parameter. Friedman has his big idea, the Friedman models, the expanding universe, but that idea is not enough to tell him what the geometry is. Someone, an astronomer, has to actually go and measure to try and decide which one of these three possibilities represents our universe. They're all consistent within themselves. Further, he also made a prediction, which is quite interesting, which is that he realized that there was a connection, strong connection, between the shape of space and the way the universe expanded. This is what his equation gave him. And he found that these three possibilities correspond to three different possibilities for the expansion of the universe. This one being a universe that recollapses, this one being a universe that expands forever, this one balancing precariously in between these two possibilities. His models make a very definite prediction. You should be able to go and measure how the universe is expanding. You should be able to measure the geometry of the universe. Do these two things satisfy the relationship that Friedman's models predict? Yeah. And so that's a strong idea of how... I think I really like this at all. It gives us a strong idea of how models can both tell us something about the universe and make predictions in case we don't know what the answer is. So that's all theoretical development, but things move on now on an observational side with one of the major astrophysicists of the 20th century, Edwin Hubble. By all accounts, he is a very impressive figure, and to prove this, I have a quote here, which is a quote from his wife on first meeting him. He's an Olympian, tall, strong, and beautiful, with the shoulders of the Hermes of Praxiteles, sense of power channeled and directed in an adventure that had nothing to do with personal ambition. I think it's fair to say that she was quite besotted with him. At least no one has said anything like that to me, as far as I'm aware. Not even Katrina back there. In case you don't know your ancient Greek sculpture, incidentally, there is the Hermes, as sculpted by Praxiteles. The resemblance actually escapes me, but perhaps if you look closely. There's also a bit of a postscript to this story as well. Unfortunately, Grace Hubble was married at the time she first met Hubble. And obviously in the 1920s, that's all a bit unfortunate and seemed to stymie the romance pretty much since it started. But there was a happy ending, because her first husband suddenly, unexpectedly, fell down a mine shaft to his death. And the coast was then clear for Grace to go on and marry Edwin Hubble. Now, he's a major figure for two reasons. Now, most people discover zero very important things in their scientific careers. Very occasionally, someone discovers one. Hubble discovers two things, which are of key importance to us. This is one. In 1924, he was able to resolve stars in other galaxies. Now, you can look at other galaxies. Perhaps you can even see them through naked eye, the Andromeda Galaxy, for example. What we now know is that we have our own galaxy, the Milky Way. It contains a very large number of stars in a collection, but it's not all there is to the universe. There are lots of other galaxies, and these other galaxies are all pretty much like the one that we live in. But back at this time, no one knows that, and there's a lot of debate about whether the Milky Way is the entire universe and whether these fuzzy blobs that people were seeing are part of the Milky Way rather than part of the wider universe. But Hubble managed to resolve individual stars in the Andromeda Galaxy, and by doing so, he opened up the universe. He showed that it's stacked full of galaxies, all like our own Milky Way or similar, some bigger, some smaller. And that is how we see the universe today. But that's not all. He made a second discovery. In working with Milton Humason in 1929, he measured the expansion rate of the universe. We now know this is Hubble's law. I'm not sure why it's not the Hubble-Humason law, but I should mention biographically, Humason's an interesting character because his first job was actually as the mule driver who carted the supplies up the mountain to the telescope where Hubble was working. And he's, from that rather basic beginning, he managed to work his way up to become a janitor at the observatory. And then occasionally people would let him move things around, and then they'd let him use the telescope. And every time he did this, he did it much better than anyone else could. And eventually he finished up as a major observer in his own right, and with Hubble, measured for the first time the expansion rate of the universe. So I think you'll agree, a very good example of working up from the bottom and reaching the top. Now, I've actually phrased this quite carefully, just as a historical note here, that he measured the expansion rate of the universe. It's very widely believed by astronomers, as well as by other people, that Hubble discovered the expansion of the universe. Now, I'd like to set the record straight. I believe it would be fair to say that the expansion of the universe was actually discovered by this guy, Vesto Slipher. First, I have to say, take a look at that. What a fantastic name. Vesto Slipher. He should have been a Bond villain. Wasted as an astronomer then. But he was actually the earlier generation to Hubble, and he made measurements which more or less incontrovertibly demonstrated the universe was expanding around 1915, but he didn't push his idea very strongly and didn't carry the community with him in the way that Hubble was later able to do. Take things forward a little bit further now. George Gamow and his collaborators are the next bunch of people to consider because they invented a thing called the hot Big Bang model. So far we've talked about the expansion of the universe and that's all. But at this point we want to turn our attention to the fact that there's stuff in the universe and we want to know how the stuff in the universe is behaving. If you expand any gas, it could be gas in a piston, for example, or in some kind of physics experiment, if you expand a gas, it cools. The universe is no different. If the universe is expanding, it will be cooling as it expands. Nowadays, it's pretty cool, but in the distant past, it must have been very, very hot. And these guys were the first to realize it, particularly George Gamow and his, I think, then students, Ralph Alpher on the right and Robert Herman on the left. I've shown this slide before, actually, and I've always commented that this is the first slide where we see someone who's still alive. But sadly, this is not true. Ralph Alpher died just 2 months ago. Then having done his work right at the start of his career and then living to an age of around 90 or so. Gamow was particularly interested in understanding what might have happened when the universe was very young, and the kind of time scale he was interested in was 1 second old. And what he reckoned was that around 1 second, the temperature in the universe would be very, very hot, around 10,000 million degrees hot, which is actually hotter than any temperature you can readily make on Earth. There. And at that time, nuclear reactions should be very important. And he was interested in how hydrogen and helium and other such things might form in the universe at that time. But in fact, it was his students and collaborators, Alpher and Herman, who made what ultimately would be the more important discovery. They predicted the existence of a thing called the cosmic microwave background way back in 1948. And nowadays, the cosmic microwave background is the premier tool of the observational cosmologist. What it is simply just leftover heat from the Big Bang. It's radiation, it fills the universe, diffuses it. is now at a temperature of only about 3 Kelvin or so, 3 degrees above absolute zero, which relic radiation that was left over from the early hot phases of the universe and is still all around us today and is readily detected by astronomical observations. They predicted it, everyone immediately forgot about it, and it was only in 1964 that it was rediscovered by accident by these guys, Arno Penzias on the right and Robert Wilson on the left, using a radio telescope called the Hollandel telescope sitting in the background. Quite a chunky thing, especially bearing in mind that a modern detector that would be much more powerful than that would be about the size of my pinky, more or less. But they discovered relic radiation. They were annoyed with it because it was interfering with the radio signals they were trying to measure. But having found it, they couldn't explain it. Eventually, it was realized it was radiation suffusing the universe and indeed was vindicating the idea of the hot Big Bang model. And at this time, this is really when the hot Big Bang steady state universe debate ended as a serious debate. The hot Big Bang model was easily able to explain this radiation as being left over from when the universe was very hot. The steady state model had no explanation of this. And so from this time onwards, the hot Big Bang model is what everyone talks about, and that remains so to the present day. So we use Friedman's equations supplemented by the equations of the hot universe to give the hot Big Bang cosmology. So around about this time, the number of parameters that people are interested in, the things we want to try and measure about our universe, has got up to 2. And the phrase that was used by a famous astronomer, Alan Sandage, at this time was that cosmology was a search for 2 numbers. There's some dispute about which 2 numbers these are, but I would take them as being the Hubble constant is the expansion rate of the universe, and the other is the total density of the universe. How much stuff is there in the universe? And if you know these 2 things, you can combine them using Friedman's model to tell you what the curvature is. If you know any 2 of these 3 things, Friedman's equation tells you the last one. So what you should be trying to do is find these 2 numbers. So the concept I want you to have in your head here is we've got the hot Big Bang cosmology, and it's told us a lot about the universe, a lot about the physical laws that govern it. But it hasn't told us the whole story because we don't know these 2 parameters. So you should think of there as being lots of possible universes, all consistent, all perfectly reasonable. But of all these possible universes, there can only be one that is our actual true universe. And what we want to know is which one it is. The way we do that is by figuring out what the values of these quantities are. And so that all sounds fairly straightforward, measure 2 things. But it all goes wrong quite quickly when you discover that you need more than that. And I introduce the most alarming thing about modern cosmology, dark things. It starts with this guy, Fritz Zwicky, always called the Maverick Fritz Zwicky, a bit of a madman, lots of bizarre ideas, but also very, very, very clever indeed. He started out as a Swiss-Hungarian who worked in the US. And way, way back in the 1930s, this is around the time of Hubble or soon after that, he was taking a look at a group of galaxies, something we now call the Coma Cluster. It's a group of galaxies. Remember, Hubble's shown that the universe is full of galaxies. Zwicky's seen this area where there happen to be a lot of them. He sees them moving around. He thinks, what's causing these galaxies to move relative to each other? It must be their gravitational attraction. They must be pulling each other together. So I'll just look and I'll figure out how massive these galaxies are. That will tell me how strong the gravity is, and that will explain these motions, and I'll have a nice consistent picture of how a cluster of galaxies works. And the trouble is it doesn't work at all. It turns out that the gravitational force seems to be much, much stronger, maybe 100 times stronger than was predicted by just looking at the galaxies. And Zwicky went way out on a limb with very little justification at all and postulated that that meant there was a whole lot of stuff in the universe that we couldn't see. Dark matter, sometimes called hidden matter, lots and lots of stuff out there of some unknown type. And it seems an outrageous extrapolation because usually when you see something unusual in observations, it's because your observations are wrong for some reason. But it turned out that Zwicky was probably right, and no one believed this for about 40 years, but eventually in the 1970s, Vera Rubin, shown here, studied not groups of galaxies, but the dynamics of individual galaxies and watched how galaxies spun around. And she confirmed the same effect. Gravity seemed to be much stronger. There had to be more material there, giving extra gravitational attraction. And her work was so secure that there was really nothing left to argue, and cosmologists had to accept that the universe was probably full of some stuff that we didn't know what it was, that we could sense only through its gravitational effects. on things in the universe. So suddenly, we have more than two cosmological parameters. We used to just have the total density of stuff in the universe, but now we've got two kinds of stuff. We've got the stuff we're made of, protons, neutrons, electrons, and we've got this dark stuff. So rather than just figure out what the total density is, we have to figure out how that density is divided between these two separate ingredients. Now, one of the main tools to do this was becoming apparent around the same time, around 1970 or so, through the work of these cosmologists and their groups, Yakov Zeldovich in the Soviet Union, James Peebles in the US, who began to be interested in the formation of structures in the universe. And by structures here, what I mean typically are galaxies. How did the galaxies get there? But also perhaps how the galaxies are grouped together. What causes galaxies to be assembled in the way that we see them in the universe? And they devised a theory which is called gravitational instability. And gravitational instability is a little bit like capitalism. What it says is that if you've got lots of stuff, it's very easy to get more stuff. Whereas if you haven't got lots of stuff, generally speaking, people take stuff away from you. And gravitational instability is like that. If you imagine the universe and you've got a region where there's a lot of stuff and you've got a region where there's not so much stuff, the region with lots of stuff exerts more gravitational attraction on the neighboring regions. And so it tends to pull in that material, accrete it together. So regions which start out with more material get amplified. They gather in more and more. Regions that didn't have very much lose it, and the money drifts away at the edge. And this is the idea of gravitational instability. It's called gravitational instability because it's saying if you started off with a very uniform distribution of material, that couldn't continue in the universe because any initial irregularities would be amplified through this gravitational instability mechanism. Now, the key here for us, the one takeaway message from this slide, is that the way in which this process happens, gravitational instability, depends on these cosmological parameters that we're trying to measure, trying to learn about. For example, if the universe is expanding more rapidly, then you can well imagine that it will be harder for gravity to overcome that expansion and pull galaxies together. If there's more material in the universe, more dark matter, for example, that will give us extra gravity, so structures will form more quickly. So this process may be complicated, but it depends on these things that we're interested in, the cosmological parameters. And so if we can measure how this process works, we can learn something about our universe that way. And this turns out to be a very powerful tool. I want to try and just encapsulate that in a single image, in a quick movie, which shows what's called gravitational instability in action here. It won't take very long to look at. So this is an initial distribution of material here. And in this computer simulation, you see some regions are slightly more dense than others. And as time goes by, they tend to gather together more material. Here. This region would be a large cluster of galaxies. Each one of these small blobs is more or less, you could think of as being an individual galaxy, so as large as our Milky Way galaxy. If you don't know what a simulation is, incidentally, that's the definition from the Oxford English Dictionary up at the top corner there. What we end up with here is what people often call the cosmic web, and you can see why it's called that. The structure in the universe that is predicted by our models looks as if you have knots in the middle. You have long filaments with lots of galaxies in these areas here. You have large voids where there isn't very much. This is a prediction from a model, but this is something that you can go out and compare with something you might observe, actually, to observe, for instance, the positions of galaxies in the nearby universe. But it turns out that galaxies also are not the best thing to use to do this, and so the next step is to look at what's the back of the cosmic microwave background. We talked about its discovery in 1964 by Penzias and Wilson, but for around 25 years or more after that, the cosmic microwave background appeared to be completely uniform. You could observe it that way, that way, that way. Whichever way you looked, it always seemed to have the same temperature, 2.725 Kelvin there. And that shouldn't be right, because if you look at our universe, there are all these galaxies and structures. And if I look in some directions, I see lots of galaxies. In other directions, I don't see so many. And those irregularities ought to be imprinted on the cosmic microwave background. It doesn't make sense that it can be uniform if the distribution of material in the universe is not. So cosmologists were predicting that there ought to be these irregularities. And it turned out they were very, very hard to detect. And it took up until 1989 before they were, by this NASA satellite mission called the COBE satellite. And this is its final picture here. I don't want to describe it in detail now because I'll show you better pictures a little bit later on. But what it did was it made the first detection of these irregularities, often called anisotropies, in the cosmic microwave background, announced in 1992, and then this map here is from 1996 at the end. It turns out that these irregularities are exactly the irregularities which will later form the galaxies in our universe. So the reason why this map is irregular is there's a bit more material here than there is here. And ultimately, this region, slightly colder in fact, that has more material, it will draw in neighboring material and will lead to the formation of galaxies and galaxy clusters. So we're seeing two different aspects of the same thing. In the cosmic microwave background, the temperature variations are very, very small. They're measured in microkelvin, or perhaps tens of microkelvin. So you need extraordinarily sensitive detectors in order to measure these differences. And you need to go into space in order to avoid contamination from the atmosphere and from astrophysical sources. This was a key discovery. In one way, in physics, you can find out whether something's a key discovery or not is whether someone wins a Nobel Prize for it. And indeed, the scientist John Mather at the top and George Smoot holding, I don't know what, something invisible, were awarded the Nobel Prize last year, in fact, almost a year ago to the day, for the discovery of the anisotropies in the cosmic microwave background. So we're almost finished this tour of how the cosmological model arrived, but not quite. There's more dark stuff. And this is definitely the dirty secret of cosmologists. We've already talked about dark matter. And dark matter was introduced in order to give us extra gravitational attraction to allow galaxies and clusters of galaxies to form. And our models just don't work without it. This has been shown time and time again. But in the late 1990s, there was another horrific discovery that was not expected by cosmologists. And the discovery was that the universe, the expansion of the universe, is presently accelerating. Things are moving apart, the universe is expanding. But everyone had thought that this expansion would be slowing down because gravitational attraction would be pulling things back. It has no right to be doing anything else. But in fact, various observations for aficionados, observations of type 1a supernovae, various observations show us that the universe appears to be accelerating at present. And none of the cosmological models that we've written down so far can describe that. Friedman's models always have deceleration of the expansion. So this has forced cosmologists into a bit of a corner because no one knows what's causing this acceleration. We do, however, have a nice word for it. Dark energy, coined by Michael Turner in 1998. If you ever hear a cosmologist talk about dark energy, what they're talking about is how they might explain why the universe is accelerating. Dark energy has nothing to do with dark matter. They're two completely separate concepts. They behave differently. And we don't really know what dark matter is, but we definitely, definitely don't know what dark energy is. In fact, it's really just words. I might as well say there's stuff causing the acceleration. I can call it dark energy, but naming something doesn't help you understand it. And what we're going to need to do is learn more about it. There's an interesting closing of the loop here in that there are some ideas for what this dark energy might be. And the very simplest one of these is a thing called the cosmological constant. It's a kind of an energy of empty space that's predicted by quantum mechanics. Now, it turns out that the cosmological constant was first predicted by none other than Albert Einstein, who was right at the start of our story back in 1915. And the idea fell from favor almost immediately in his era, but has come back again in modern cosmology. And so that brings us more or less up to date as to what the ingredients are that we might need to make a cosmological model. Hot Big Bang cosmology, gravitational instability causes structures to form, dark matter is required to give us that extra gravity, dark energy is needed to make the universe accelerate. And so before looking at the present situation, I just wanted to have a little break to try and tell you a little bit about what a theoretical cosmologist actually does, because you might be in some doubt at the moment. So what do I actually do? I decided I wasn't sure. I thought about it for a while, and I decided I didn't really know. So I asked my trusty Mac computer here to carry out a little bit of covert surveillance using its camera, conveniently stuck in the top. And what I discovered is I basically spend all my time staring at my computer screen, looking dismayed. And I now have a lot of photos. a lot of photographs of myself sitting at a computer screen in various states of dismay. However, this does occasionally lead to some sort of productivity, and I want to give you a glimpse of what this looks like. Michael at the start already suggested what some of this stuff looks like, but so that you really know, this is what it looks like. If I have a supervision meeting with a student, Marina Cortez in this case, who's sitting there in yellow, this is what my whiteboard might look like afterwards. I'm not sure I understand any of it, so I challenge any of you to. If I've been scrolling on a piece of paper, for example, with my student Cedric Pahu, who's here somewhere, I'm sure, right up at the back, this is what my piece of paper might look like after I've scribbled on it. If I've written it up as a paper, which is more or less what Michael was alluding to, in this case with another student, Martin Salen, then it might look a bit like this, with lots of funny equations and figures and stuff. Now, clearly you don't want to hear any more about that. But that is what actually happens when you work in cosmology. Now, I do want to mention a little bit about what we do specifically at Sussex. So far I've talked about history. What I'm talking about after this slide is going to mostly again be about the world cosmology effort. But I want to say a little bit about Sussex's place in that. Cosmology is a big, complicated subject, and there's probably several thousand people worldwide working on various aspects of it. So if you're in a department like ours at Sussex, where there are maybe 40 people working on cosmology, you need to have your specialisms, the areas where you want to make an impact. So what do we actually do? What are our specialisms? One thing is the physics of the early universe. There's a very long tradition at Sussex, going back, nearly 30 years from the early work of John Barrow, but particularly from when Ed Copeland up front there and myself and Peter Thomas all joined Sussex in 1989. And what we're trying to understand is how physics of the very early universe might make itself visible in the present universe. This is the interface of particle physics and astronomy, where ideas that come from particle physics like superstring theory, supersymmetry, grand unified theories, might make themselves evident in the present universe and might be indeed the best way to test that. Another thing we do is we apply high-performance computing to cosmological problems, really using some of the best available computers. For example, this is the Cosmos supercomputer based in Cambridge. Stephen Hawking is the overall project PI. Sussex has been part of that since its inception around 12 years ago now. This is the seventh version of the Cosmos supercomputer. In this case, around 200 processors in these racks, giving us access to the computer power that we need to try and solve the problems we're dealing with. We're interested in statistical approaches to cosmology and trying to get the very, very best information we can from observational data. In a talk like this, you get to hide the fact that the real data is actually rather complicated, and interpreting what the data means is rather complicated. But people spend huge sums of money getting that data. A satellite mission will come in at £1 billion, roughly, perhaps. So you have to be sure you can get the absolute best information. And so we're very interested in developing powerful statistical techniques. And we're particularly big fans of what's called Bayesian statistics. And a lot of our time goes into that. And the other thing we do here at Sussex is large cosmological surveys. So this is largely theory. Down here is our observational part of our program. If you want to make big discoveries now, you have to be part of big projects. If you're not, you don't have access to the high-quality data that people are going to make discoveries with. And so we've been working very hard over the last few years to get people in the group associated with a whole range of major survey projects. So that's what we do. But now back to the current state of cosmology, as I understand it. So what cosmologists like me tend to talk about just now is the era of precision cosmology. And this started around 2003, for reasons I'll describe. And it's this thing I said right at the very start. How do you get precision models? You need precision observations, but you also need precision theory, models of the universe that allow you to understand the observations you're making. And these two things come together, and so there's a complex network of things, computers, telescopes, satellites, and even a bit of just sitting in your office thinking from time to time about how things work. So these are the ingredients that come together to create what we would say is the first precision cosmological model, meaning that we're measuring the parameters, the properties of the universe, at accuracies better than, say, 10% or so. So a reminder, what cosmological model? This is the clever ideas bit of how you stick a model together. We have these ideas, And they're the hot Big Bang cosmology. There's structure formation by gravitational instability. There's the ingredients, dark matter, dark energy, and so on. And we also have an extra bit that I'm not talking about today, but wanted just to mention in passing, a thing called the inflationary cosmology, which is supposed to explain the initial irregularities in the universe. So gravitational instability takes irregularities in the young universe that we see in the cosmic microwave background and evolves them so that they become things like galaxies and groups of galaxies. We actually have a theory of where those initial irregularities might have come from, because you need something to get the whole process going. And inflationary cosmology is something we've been very closely associated with at Sussex over many years. But these are the ideas. They're the cosmological model. But they're not the thing I've been calling the cosmic fingerprint, which is the title of this lecture, or almost the title of this lecture here. Those are the assumptions. They tell us about how we think the universe behaves, but they don't tell us in detail how our own universe looks. They still leave open many, many possible universes. And so we have lots of questions left over, like how fast is the universe expanding? Theory doesn't tell you. You have to go and measure it. What are the amounts of these different kinds of things? We now know the universe is full of atoms, radiation, the cosmic microwave background, but the dark matter, the dark energy. How much of each of these things is there? Which one's the dominant one? Which one's the most important during the early universe? How old's the universe? These are all the sorts of questions that we're trying to answer with cosmological data. And the aim is to figure out which of all possible universes that are allowed by our big ideas, which of all of those possible universes do we actually live in? And the secret to this appears to be the cosmic microwave background. And in particular, if we look at the cosmic microwave background in detail, each of the different possible universes predicts that the structures seen in the cosmic microwave background should be different. So in this mock-up, it's a classic NASA picture here, the cosmic microwave background's been smeared out by a fingerprint. The idea is if you can measure the properties of the microwave background in detail, it's like a fingerprint. In its structures, it contains all the information that lets you unravel the answers to these questions, pin down the nature of our universe. So which of all these possible universes is our one? So as a project which we were not involved in at Sussex other than in analyzing the data, which set out to do this and succeeded in very grand style. The Wilkinson Microwave Anisotropy Probe is a NASA satellite named after David Wilkinson, who sadly died, I think, just after the launch of the satellite in 2001. They're aiming to make very high precision maps of the cosmic microwave background. And here it is being launched on a Delta rocket. It's stuck in the fairing up at the top there. Then I remember, actually, I watched this launch. This was the very, very early days of webcasts. So nowadays, you know, you're used to webcamming anything you like. But in those days, they had a webcast of this launch. The trouble with it was it only updated roughly every 15 seconds. So you stare at a photo. So we're looking at a photo. It's this tiny thing on the screen. 15 seconds later, basically the same thing, because it's a rocket and a launch pad, and not very much happens. But the countdown's counting down. You think, it's going to launch soon. And then you see one, and it's 10 seconds to launch, still sitting there. Then the next one, there's just an enormous cloud of smoke. Completely fills the whole picture. You can see nothing but a cloud of smoke. Then their server crashes. This picture of cloud of smoke then sits on their server for 2 hours, with no one having the slightest clue whether or not that was the satellite blowing up on the launch pad, or, as happened, successfully launching into space to try and carry out some observations. This is a kind of a zoom that's supposed to eventually show you how this works. They're zoomed into part of the cosmic microwave background, and the picture we have here is that that's a region where galaxies will form. So in the simulation here, lots of galaxies start to form. This is going forwards in time in the evolution of the universe. But the microwave background radiation still there is traveling through all of this intervening material, all of these galaxies that are forming. And at the end, you have your satellite in orbit around the Earth, or in this case, in orbit around the Sun, making observations of the cosmic microwave background. And the final result it comes up with is this. Now, you're going to have to take my word for it. This is fantastic. This is extraordinary, remarkable, one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I know it doesn't look that good to you, and it just looks like fuzzy blobs on a screen. But inside this map is the secret to the universe and figuring out all of the details of the universe in which we live. Now, what are we seeing here? This is a map of the radiation that's coming to us from all different directions around the sky. So really coming from the surface of a sphere. To project it on the screen, it's had to be laid out flat. So if you think of taking an orange and you peel it from North Pole to South Pole and open it up and lay it flat, then you can display the whole sky on the screen. And this shows you the different temperatures coming from different regions. And all of these features you see are real features. When the universe was young, you had these variations from point to point. And in these regions, galaxies will later form in clusters of galaxies. I actually have, as a prop, one day in my mailbox, a beach ball arrived from NASA, unsolicited, which is actually the same thing. You can see it there. But this is quite convenient because if you have a beach ball, then it's properly representing the sphere from which the radiation comes from. What you have to imagine is you're sitting right in the middle of the sphere, in the center of the beach ball, looking out in different directions, and then you can see. And what that highlights to you maybe better is you'll notice this bright red band across the middle. It's actually not to do with cosmology. That's emission from our own galaxy there. It's like the Milky Way, only in microwave radiation rather than visible radiation. But all the other stuff is real, and you should all have a look at it. But be careful, it is the universe. Pass it around, see what you think there. And you can see what the universe looks like. Now, I'm going to skip my next slide, I think, or go to here. That's the picture, and you've seen the pictures, but in reality, we have to do some kind of statistical analysis to try and understand what this is telling us. And I do want to show you one graph because it's reasonably compelling, I think, as to why WMAP was such a change in our cosmological understanding. This is the first year data from WMAP, released on the 11th of February, 2003. Ignore this bottom plot. What this top plot is showing us is measurements of the size of features in the cosmic microwave background on different angular scales. Here, if you look up at the top, is about 1 degree or so. And the only thing really to take away is the fact there's a strong peak there is telling you that you should see a lot of features on that beach ball, wherever it's gone, that are about a degree in size. That is the most prominent structure. And then there are less prominent structures on larger angular scales, large fluctuations, and then other things here. And the technical name for this is the power spectrum. What it's measuring is the different modes, the different frequencies you see in the cosmic microwave background there. This is the 11th of February, 2003. Had you seen this plot on the 10th of February, 2003, it would have looked something like this. This is a collection of all the cosmic microwave background data that had ever been taken up until that day. All these different experiments, all stuck on the same curve. And you can kind of see a little bit, you know, you can see there's a rise here, that there's more structure here, but it's a real mess. And deriving any cosmological information from that mess was very difficult. Then in a single announcement, the data goes from that to this. And these data these points have error bars. You can't even see the error bars here. They're too small to see. Over here, eventually, you can see them. But these data points are exquisitely accurately measured. And on top of that, this red line is not just a line that someone's done join the dots and stuck, tried to put them all together. This red line is a prediction from a theoretical model, and indeed a prediction which had been in the cosmological literature for perhaps 20 years before these observations were made. And the points just sit beautifully on that line. Just look at how beautiful that is. And I cannot think of another example, probably in science even, where a prediction has stood for 20 years and then been verified to that sort of precision by subsequent observations. And because of that, this is the predictiveness of the theory. That gives me very strong faith that we are going in the right direction and the kinds of models we're dealing with are able to describe the data. So what do you get from it? From it, you extract a whole pile of numbers. We don't want to look at all of these by any means, but this is, again, from the WMAP team. These are all numbers describing our universe, different properties of our universe, measured with error bars from that data. I'll just highlight a couple of you here. This is the age of the universe, T0, 13.7 plus or minus 0.2 gigayears. The universe is 13.7 thousand million years old with a tiny error bar. Before this data came along, people would argue, is it 10 billion? Is it 15 billion? Is it 18 billion? Now we know it very accurately. densities of other types of material, lots of numbers here, temperature of the microwave background, all of this information, very high precision, but I just wanted to take away the idea that these numbers exist. We don't care in this talk what they actually represent, I think. So I'm coming towards my conclusion here. These models are very, very good, meaning that they describe the data extraordinarily well. And I like to use the phrase standard cosmological model. We have a model which is the model which seems best able to describe the data. But there is a problem with it, and the problem with it is that the reason why we made all of these measurements was supposed to be because we were going to understand something fundamental about our universe. And just having a model isn't quite good enough to do that. We were really hoping to get some fundamental understanding, and we don't yet have it. For example, we've measured lots of things. What are the ingredients of the universe? How much dark matter? How much dark energy? We know these things very well. How fast does the universe expand? But we don't know what these things are. What is the dark matter? I don't know. Pretty sure you don't know either. Do we understand why the universe is filled with matter and not antimatter? No, no idea at all. Dark energy, do I know what that is? Don't think so. I know these things are there. The observations are very, very compelling. You can look out in the universe. You can't explain why the universe is behaving as it does unless these things exist. But we don't know how they connect to other parts of physics, particle physics, for example. And that's a big, big gap in our knowledge. And that's where future cosmology is going to lie. What we're going to need to try and resolve this is to try and get more data. And so that's where we're going to be very busy, I think, in Sussex over the coming years. For example, here are two large surveys coming up that we've got good involvement in. The Planck satellite is a European Space Agency satellite. It's like WMAP, but much better again. It's another quantum leap, both in angular resolution and sensitivity. It should launch late next year. We've been spending about 10 years waiting for that to happen, but I think we're within about a year of that now. Another very important project we're involved in is the Dark Energy Survey, where we're going to try and learn more about the properties of dark energy, or at least try and decide whether or not Einstein's cosmological constant is a good model. And so that's where I'm going to end. Thank you very much.
Andrew, fantastic lecture. I expected nothing less. I too had wondered why it had taken Andrew 7 years to do his professorial lecture. 2 days after France lost to Scotland in the Stade de France, I received an email from Andrew, "I'm doing my professorial lecture." And I think that summarized it. He was waiting for the big win. And then he decided, right, now I'll go for it. Andrew and I have known each other for about 18 years. And we arrived at Sussex within a few days of each other. And what's special about Andrew and his work in cosmology is that he comes from both a particle physics background in Glasgow, where he did his PhD. He worked on more particle aspects of the subject. And then when he came to Sussex, he began to get interested a lot more in the astrophysics side of cosmology. Now, in this field, you either have one or the other. You tend not to have both camps sort of managing to work side by side. And Andrew brought this skill to him, with him. And he also has this great ability to focus in on a problem and attack it. And the one that comes to mind was when I came here, soon after me, Mark Hindmarsh arrived. We both worked on a subject called cosmic strings. Andrew was very interested in a subject called inflation, as he mentioned. And he didn't like cosmic strings. He didn't think they worked. And he kept telling us this in seminars after seminars. As we'd invite speakers, why are you inviting them? They're not working. Eventually, he says, they're ruled out because he knew about the parameters. And so eventually, we all clubbed together and we bought him a ruler and we called it Andrew's Ruling Out Ruler. And we presented it to him as a, because he kept ruling out our model. He was right, unfortunately. So I've been very lucky working with Andrew. I think we've written 30 papers or something together. On the way down, I was thinking, what's special about him as someone to work with, apart from being a great collaborator? And I think you saw it in the presentation. He has, as well as attacking a problem, he has a way of looking at the actual global side of the subject. And so whereas I tend to get stuck in, this factor of three or something's stuck here, and he's looking at a bigger picture of it. He's less concerned. He can do the maths, don't worry. He can do the maths, but he's less concerned about it. It's the bigger picture. He has an idea of what he thinks the answer should be, I think, before he actually really embarks on it. And that's a very powerful weapon to have at your disposal, because then no matter what the factors are that come out, you have a feeling whether you're right or wrong. And Andrew has that gift, and that's what's made him. I mean, you're very lucky at Sussex to have him, because he's without doubt one of the leading cosmologists in the world today, and in particular his work on constraining the cosmological parameters, this ability to take the data and analyze it, and from it tell you what are the most likely outcomes in terms of all these cosmological models. It's a great gift to have, and you're very lucky. And I think you heard it today, his ability to give that information out, it's second to none. So perhaps you'd join me in saying thank you to Andrew.
Andrew, Ed, thank you both very much indeed. I'm sure you will all agree that this was an absolute model presentation. And even for those of us who can't look at numbers and symbols, the understanding that Andrew gave us today about the universe in which we live was extraordinary. I'd now like you to, from this part of the universe, expand out through that door into the reception area where there will be some refreshments to share with Andrew. And I'm sure those of you who've got the really difficult questions, you can continue the debate outside. Thank you all very much.